So when we started this study, we began by talking about the concept of mountaintops of faith. And for a believer, a mountaintop is a place that you can stand high upon of objective historical evidence that allows you to have a clear view of this world and what to expect when the end of life comes to each one of us. And you are at a place of strong fortification where no matter what the enemies of Jesus will throw at you, they can never topple you or remove your faith, tear you down, and lead you into a life of unbelief and sin. For the skeptic, this mountaintop is what Mount Everest would be to probably every one of us in here. It's unscalable. You just cannot get around it. And that's kind of where we are right now as we talk about eliminating the impossible. When it comes to the evidence for the resurrection, the skeptic must do one of three things. He must either demonstrate a fallacy in our logic, which is what the philosophy of naturalism attempts to do and fails horribly at. If not that, then he must discredit the evidence altogether. And so they invent this lie that the gospel is a recycled pagan myth. And that doesn't hold up. The other thing that they must do is present an alternative explanation that is just as plausible as the resurrection. And what we mean by plausible is it has to explain the facts. It has to account for the facts in a way better than the resurrection story found in the Bible does. So to that end, we have had three theories submitted to us tonight to try to explain the data that we have without resorting to the supernatural to account for all five of our stubborn facts. The stolen body theory, the swoon theory, and the hallucination theory. And we'll talk about these three tonight. Obviously, there's a lot more theories out there. Most of them are a variation on one of these three. And if one of these three falls apart, or if these three fall apart, then all the variations of them fall apart as well. So let's talk about the first one that we have, the stolen body theory, and let's be opening up to Matthew 28, where we first find this objection to the resurrection story. A lot of interesting things about this. First of all, it's the golden oldie of fraud theories. It's been around since the first century. From the very earliest, when the tomb was found empty, and when the guards went away to their superiors and reported that it was empty, this is what they told them to tell people. In verse 11, while they were on their way, some of the guard came into the city and reported to the chief priest all that had happened. And when they had assembled with the elders and consulted together, they gave a large sum of money to the soldiers and said, "You are to say his disciples came by night and stole him away while we were asleep. And if this should come to the governor's ears, we will win him over and keep you out of trouble." And they took the money and did as they had been instructed. And the story was widely spread among the Jews and is to this day. So the first thing that we have to do, because even though the Jews were the ones to say this, and even though it's recorded within the Gospels, and even by Matthew's own writings, it seems to be something that he expects the reader to easily not buy into after they've considered what his gospel has to say, we still need to account for it. Because other variations of this exist, even today. Sometimes people might say that the Jews stole the body and not the disciples, or the Romans stole the body and not the Jews or the disciples. So let's just try to figure out whether or not this explanation holds up from the facts that we have nailed down. When we talk about something being stolen, though, we are talking about theft or a crime. And one of the other things that I think we should take into consideration is what a crime scene investigator or a detective takes into account when he's trying to figure out who a guilty party really is. Means, motive, and opportunity. I think we should include those three things as well as we talk about whether or not this holds up under scrutiny. So the first thing we need to do is list our five facts. Facts that even an honest skeptic must admit to. And let's see which one of these this theory either agrees with or explains or just fails to explain altogether. So what's the first one? You die by crucifixion. So if somebody tells you that the body was stolen, from the grave. Obviously, they would at least agree that we killed him in the first place. They're not in any way contradicting the first of the five. Jesus did die by crucifixion. What about the second fact? Which one is that? Not yet. Not yet to Paul. Okay. The disciples believed that they had seen him. They thought they saw this risen Jesus come back from the dead. Does this theory explain that one? Yes or no? I tell you what, if you say no, you've got a good reason to say no. Why might you say no? It does not explain that second one. Because we might think, well, if they stole the body, they might just tell a lie and say, we saw him back from the dead. And they could get away with it, knowing full well that they know where the body is. What were you saying, Alex?
They didn't recognize him at first. Why would they put that down?
Okay, so there's some red flags in the narrative, perhaps, you know, with the women not recognizing him at first. But there's another reason that we've talked about before that lets us know that, at the very least, these men were sincere in what they said.
All the persecution that they endured.
All the persecution. That's right. So if these guys were con artists, surely one of them would have cracked at some point and told the truth and exposed the cover-up and everything else. So when we look at the fact that these men sincerely believed they saw him, this theory does not explain that. What is our third fact, Herb? That's right. Paul went from a persecutor to a preacher. He converted. Does this theory explain that? Not at all. Paul's the kind of guy who would have been probably looking for fraud at first. Desperately would have expected that if the tomb was found empty, somebody did steal the body from the tomb, and I'm going to find out who did it because I'm going to torture every Christian I can get my hands on. But then he becomes a Christian. This theory does not explain that. What's the fourth one? James converted. Does this explain James's conversion? He also said that he saw the risen Jesus. And now our fifth one. What's the fifth one? Empty tomb. Does this theory explain the empty tomb? Yes, it does. That's about the only one of the five that it explains. We've got these other four, and it completely fails to deal with them all together. At the bottom of page 51, I ask a couple more questions. Were the disciples in any frame of mind to steal the body in the first place? They were not. Look in the Gospel of Mark, chapter 14. Mark, chapter 14 and verse 50. How would you like to have this written on your tombstone? What if this is where their stories had ended? They all left him and fled. So here they are, they're confronted with men that have arms. They come and they arrest their master, their teacher, the one that they have said, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And then when they arrest him and haul him away, do they at any point say, I remember what he told us. He told us he would go to the cross and he would come back after 3 days? Not at all. One of them draws his sword, starts swinging. This is not how things were supposed to turn out in their way of thinking. When you get to chapter 16, after the women go to the tomb and they find it empty, and then they see the angels, and then they see Jesus in verse 11, they heard that he was alive and had been seen by her. They refuse to believe it. Then again, in verse 13, after the two disciples on the road came to them and told them they had seen him, they did not believe them either. And then in verse 14, in their encounter with the risen Jesus, he reproaches them for their unbelief and hardness of heart because they had not believed those who had seen him after he had risen. Now, this is critical. Go back to the Gospel of Matthew and look at chapter 27 this time. Matthew chapter 27, in verse 62. The Jews anticipated this very thing, and they acted to prevent it. In Matthew 27, verse 62, On the next day, the day after the preparation, the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered together with Pilate. They said, "Sir, we remember that when he was still alive, that deceiver said," this is incredible, by the way, because his enemies seemed to have a better grasp on what he was predicting than his own disciples did. "If this had been made up, that would not be found within your Bible." They said, "After 3 days, I am to rise again. Therefore, give orders for the grave to be made secure until the third day. Otherwise, his disciples may come and steal him away and say to the people, 'He has risen from the dead,' and the last deception will be worse than the first." Here these men are concerned that these disciples will be grave robbers. They are in no condition to be grave robbers. They didn't believe in the resurrection to begin with until after they had seen the risen Jesus. So the fraud these men are hoping to prevent, it's wasted effort. These men are in no mental state to commit fraud. The second question, even if they were in the frame of mind, were they in any position to steal the body? If you read down further in the text, first of all, what does Pilate grant them in verse 65? A guard. And then in verse 66, not just a guard, but what else do? They seal the tomb. This is an anti-tampering device they put across the grave. So back to means, motive, and opportunity. Let's concede for a moment that 11 men, they've got the means to steal the body. Presumably 11 men could roll this 500 to 600 pound stone back and get the body. Do they have the motive? They didn't even believe in his predictions about resurrection in the first place. Do they have the opportunity? Not with a guard. Not with the tomb being sealed. There's no motive. There's no opportunity. These men are not the best suspects for this alleged crime. A crime that is purported to have happened that only manages to explain one of five facts. Look on the next page. Page 52. Even if the guards were asleep, could they have possibly known what had happened to the body? Of course not. So this would be one of the first red flags in the story. You're in town in Jerusalem, and these guards are walking around, and somebody says, "I heard there was an empty tomb found." "Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, we all fell asleep on duty." Pass that pocket full of change. And, the disciples came along, and they stole the body. Well, how do you know? How do you know they're the ones that stole the body if all you fellas were asleep? If they start saying, "Well, one of us woke up," well, then why didn't you wake the rest of your comrades up? Why didn't you do something to prevent this? How could you have not heard what was going on with the stone being moved around, the seal being broken? Surely somebody would have tripped on something and woken you fellas up. The second thing is this. If they had truly fallen asleep, if that had actually happened, would they have ever admitted it?
No.
No. Look at Acts 16. These are men that obviously have some accountability to the governor. That's why the Jews tell them, if this should come to the governor's ears, we will win him over. There is a fear, or at least a concern, that they might get called to account for a dereliction of duty. In Acts 16, you have the Philippian jailer, and when he has a jailbreak on his hands, or at least thinks that his prisoners have escaped, he is about to take his sword and kill himself. And we might think that's a little bit of an overreaction. But the ruling people in the time of the Roman Empire were not above torturing people to death by means of, say, crucifixion. Perhaps they feared that something like that, or scourging or worse, might happen to them. Better to take your own life quickly and easily on your own sword than to fall into the hands of your masters who might do far, far worse. So all these things would indicate that this story is just not going to hold up. The fourth thing, and Levi alluded to this earlier with one of his answers, based on everything that we've seen so far, can we be certain of the sincerity of their claims that they saw the risen Jesus?
Yes.
Absolutely. And we can because they persevered. The last thing, here are the Jews. They say that the disciples have stolen the body. Did they not have the means at their disposal, if that was true, to find out who did it and how they pulled it off? You better believe it. Back over in Acts chapter 5. In Acts 4, they had previously threatened the apostles. If you don't stop preaching the gospel, something is going to happen to you. They refused to listen to them. And so now, after the warning is carried out, the threat is fulfilled in verse 40. They called the apostles in, they flogged them, and ordered them not to speak in the name of Jesus, and then released them. Of course, in verses 41 and 42, this did not have the desired effect. They just kept right on going, rejoicing that they had been considered worthy to suffer shame for his name. If anything, it just emboldened them. If these men had been guilty of fraud, it would not have been hard to get the truth out of them. Thoughts or comments on this first theory, the stolen body theory?
Further confirmation that they had that kind of power in Acts 8. The Jewish rulers authorized a commission to go all the way to Damascus to seek out Jews who just confessed Christ.
Right.
What about those who stole the body and substantiated the claim? Not only did they have the authority to search in Jerusalem, but to go to distances that these would be higher criminals in their view.
Right.
Right.
And if they're willing to go to Damascus, they would certainly search out Jerusalem. And we know in Acts 8, in the first part, the apostles stay within the city. So they don't even have to go that far to find those men that they have accused of being the ones behind this Passover plot, as some people put it. The body was stolen and this great myth was invented that a lot of people have just bought into. All right, the second one. The swoon theory. This one has been around a long time too. I think this one might date all the way back to the 2nd century. It is very, very popular among skeptics. And the appeal is obvious. It does a little bit better job of explaining more of the undeniable facts that we have about the case. So here's the theory. Instead of dying on the cross, Jesus became unconscious. And instead of a resurrection, he experienced a resuscitation. In the coolness of the tomb, 3 days, gets to take a breather, and all the herbs and stuff they buried him with, they just sort of help rejuvenate him. And voila, gets out of the tomb on his own, and that was it. So once again, let's go through the first 5. And we've got a problem right off the bat. Because the first one says what? He died, didn't pass out. He died, and there were a few soldiers around at the cross. In fact, if you look over in John 19, verse 23. And Roman soldiers, these guys were pretty bad. I was listening to a historian talk about what's been called the Celtic Holocaust, when the Romans invaded the area that we call France and other parts of Europe today, and were just laying waste to people. These guys, death and murder and torture, that was their business by trade. They were experts at it. In John 19 and verse 23, then the soldiers, when they had crucified Jesus, took his outer garments and made 4 parts, a part to every soldier. There's 4 of these guys standing at the cross with him. Surely one of them would have noticed if they had not killed the man. You wonder how many years of experience between the 4 in killing people do they have? How many crucifixion details have they served on and been made to make sure that nobody survived the cross? So it does not explain the first one. What about the second one, though? The disciples believe they saw him. Explain, doesn't explain.
Explains
them seeing something if he fell asleep and woke back up. What about Paul's conversion? Would it explain Paul's conversion? There's a real big problem with the details we have about Paul's conversion. We'll talk about that in a minute. I would say it does not explain that. What about James's conversion? Here's a man that did not believe in Jesus as the Messiah to begin with, just like Paul. You know, with the disciples, if this is what really happened, if the 11 saw him come back out of the tomb, not really dead, but they thought he died, and he says, I'm back just like I told you I'd come back. They had already confessed him as Lord. They'd already confessed him as the Son of God. Maybe their biases, they might have been able to overlook all the things he went through and the fact that he doesn't really look all that triumphant and victorious right now. But not Paul. Not James. This would not have convinced those kind of guys. They didn't believe in it to begin with. And what about the empty tomb? Explain? Doesn't explain?
It could explain it.
It would, right? It would explain it. So here we've got three of the five that this does not explain at all. Of those three, let's talk about it a little bit more on the next page. And let's go over to Acts chapter 9. So picture for a moment, if this theory is true, just how bad Jesus looks. We don't know how many times he was whipped with the scourges, with Jews. If Jews were the ones that were carrying out that punishment, they could not lash you more than 39 times at a stretch. But Romans had no such limitations on the amount of punishment they could deal out. How bad is his flesh? How bruised is it? Viscerated, or eviscerated, however you put it. He's got these. He'd have no blood left. And even worse, in some ways, leading up to the massive loss of blood, he's lost a lot of water, too. We know that from some other things that we'll look at here in a moment. He would have lost so much of what he needs to get by just from the scourging alone. Then he takes this awful punishment on the cross. And you think about how bad a body like that would look, and then you look in Acts 9 and verse 3, and this is Luke's record of Paul's conversion experience. It happened that he was approaching Damascus, and suddenly a light from heaven flashed around him. He fell to the ground and heard a voice saying to him, "Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me?" The next two times that his story is told, it comes straight out of his mouth. And in chapter 22 and verse 6, as he's telling this story to the Jews, a very bright light suddenly flashed from heaven all around me. And then again, when he tells the story to the Romans in chapter 26 and verse 13, "At midday, O king, I saw on the way a light from heaven brighter than the sun, shining all around me and those who were journeying with me." So when Paul sees Jesus, it is a glorious sight to behold. But if this theory is true, there is nothing whatsoever glorious about the state of Jesus' body. You'd look at what he went through and you'd think, I sure don't want to go through that. This does not at all explain Paul's conversion based on the data that we have about his own testimony. Tying into this, the third thing that I have here is a critique from skeptic David Strauss. Now, don't confuse him with David Hume. These are two different guys. But, like I said before, anytime a skeptic wants to help make the case for the resurrection, I'll sit down and shut up. It makes my job easier. Let an unbeliever make the case. He said, "It is impossible that one who had just come forth from the grave half dead, maybe 95% dead after the shock and the blood loss and the torture, impossible that one who had just come forth from the grave half dead, who crept about weak and ill, who stood in need of medical treatment, of bandaging, strengthening, and tender care, could ever have given to the disciples the impression that he was a conqueror over death and the grave, that he was the Prince of Life." Just think about it. On the night that he's betrayed and arrested, they all left him and fled. Then 3 days later, after he's crucified, they see him and he looks terrible. Yeah, they stand there and they think, "I want a resurrected body just like that. I want to have this great victory over death and pain and suffering like you have had." It takes more faith to be an atheist. This just does not make sense. Go back to John 19 for a second. So there's loss of blood. Like Sally said, if you look in John 19 and verse 28, as he's hanging on the cross, he says, "I'm thirsty." He's dehydrated before he even expires. So you think about a body that's been lying in a tomb for 3 days, tremendous blood loss, body's in critical condition, he desperately needs water, hasn't had any, no food, very, very little rest for him to have gone through all of this. Then you think about the wounds that he suffered when they drove the nails into his wrists. When the nails go into the wrist, pretty good chance they would sever or crush the median nerve. Now, if that happens, we mentioned before his hands might have curled in like that permanently. How does a man like that get himself out of the burial claws and then somehow on his own push a 500 to 600 pound stone back, then get around or overpower, if he needs to, the guards? How does he even walk? If he's already weakened and then he's laying down, think about the burial clothes. How tight did they bury somebody back then, according to the custom of the Jews, as you read in verse 40 of John 19? They took the body of Jesus and they bound it in linen wrappings with the spices. This is like you see when a mummy is buried. He's wrapped up tight. He's going to have a really hard time getting those clothes off by himself. But then, does he have any extra weight holding him down? Yeah. How much?
100 pounds.
Verse 39. Nicodemus, who had first come to him by night, also came bringing a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 100 pounds weight. This is a broken man on the verge of death. There is no way he's getting out on his own. And if I know nothing else, I know that the one thing that makes it impossible is the last thing that we have in connection with this theory. Our first fact. He didn't survive it. He died. And the one thing that confirms it above all else is found in verses 34 and 35. One of the soldiers pierced his side with a spear. And what does he observe that comes out of the body?
Blood and water.
And like we talked about, the issue of blood and water is consistent with the cellular breakdown that occurs at death. The red clotting material separates from the water-like serum. This was evidently a telltale sign for men on a crucifixion detail to know that they had indeed succeeded in killing their victim. Thoughts or comments on this theory? Alex.
I read a book about 25 years ago called The Lost Travels of Jesus. And one crazy theory the writer had was that Jesus went to India, Tibet, and learned from the yogis how to master his body. That's how he survived being crucified. And he just went to a state of meditation. And it goes on. I didn't finish reading the book.
I can't imagine why. Other thoughts? Rocky.
About him getting out of the tomb, I remember we studied about Jesus carrying his cross. So we kind of put all the facts together. It's very possible that Jesus started out on his own, carrying his cross, had difficulty, and Simon helped him, and then at the end, Simon carried it all the way. So a man who can't carry his cross, how can he get out of the tomb?
Good point.
Good point.
So the cross beam, I think 75 to 125 pounds is probably what they weighed. And if he's too weak to even carry that the full distance, he's sure not going to push back a 600-pound stone. Good point. Other comments? Okay, the last one then. So the hallucination theory, this one's not hard to get. They thought they saw something that they really did not see. So let's go through our five facts again. Death by crucifixion. This would agree with that. Jesus did in fact die. What about the second fact? Does it explain it? What is the second fact? Yeah, they thought they saw him, right? So to some degree, this one seeks to explain the second fact. They thought they saw the risen Savior. So they're just saying that they saw something in which they did not see. I suppose you could argue that perhaps Paul and James would have experienced a hallucination if you bought into this. But the problem with that is the frame of mind of those two men versus the 11. Even if you were to argue that they were in the right frame of mind to hallucinate this, I would argue that they were not. But let's just say you wanted to argue on the basis that because they were his disciples, that alone made them in the frame of mind to hallucinate. Would that be true of Paul and James? Not at all. That would not be true of them. But we've already established these men weren't even in the frame of mind to steal the body because they did not expect Jesus to come back from the dead. So are they in the frame of mind to begin with to hallucinate seeing him come back from the dead?
No.
Not at all. What about the empty tomb? Would this theory explain the empty tomb?
No.
Not at all. Not at all. So now let's talk about hallucinations a little bit. The second thing I've got there on the sheet. First question. Do groups experience hallucinations? Now, I guess it kind of depends on what you mean by the question. But the follow-up that I put is really what I'm getting at. Do they experience the exact same hallucinations?
No.
They do not. That would fly in the face of everything that has been documented about hallucinations. In one of the books that I consult for this study, The Case for the Resurrection of Jesus, they deal with this objection, and they mention that sometimes a group of people can experience a hallucination. For example, U.S. Navy SEALs, arguably the most elite fighting force in the world, prior to becoming a SEAL, has to endure what they call Hell Week. This is a pretty tough time for them. All of the candidates are put through intense exercise. They experience extreme stress during the week and only a total of 3 to 5 hours of sleep. As the fatigue and the sleep deprivation quickly set in, most of the candidates experience hallucinations. According to several SEALs interviewed, most hallucinations occur while the candidates, as a team, paddle in a raft out in the ocean. One believed that he saw an octopus come out of the water and wave at him. Another thought he saw a train coming across the water, headed straight toward the raft. Another believed that he saw a large wall, which the raft would crash into if the team persisted in paddling. When the octopus, the train, and the wall were pointed out by the candidates to the rest of the team, guess how many other people saw these things? No one else saw them, even though they were all in the same frame of mind. Most of them hallucinated at some point, but none of them participated in the hallucination of another. So, let's go back to our appearances that Jesus made. We've got at least one, two, three appearances, at least those three, where it was just to one person that we know of. Peter, Paul, and James. But think about all the other appearances that Jesus made that are recorded for us in the four Gospels. For example, the first people to find the risen Savior are the women. Mary Magdalene, the other Mary, Salome, Joanna, and Luke says others. We don't know how many women there were in this group that saw Jesus. Now, when you hallucinate something, you are experiencing something that is playing a trick on your eyes. It only interferes with, as far as I know, just the one sense of sight. But in the case of the women, did they engage any other senses in their encounter with Jesus? They heard him. What else? They touched him. Some of the women fell down at his feet and worshipped him. Then you have the two disciples on the road to Emmaus. Now these men have a conversation with Jesus, lasts maybe 2 hours. They both experience the exact same so-called hallucination over a prolonged period of time that involves a change of scenery, going from the road into an inn and inviting this man that they're talking to sit down and have a meal. After this, he appears to 10 on the Resurrection Sunday. A week after that, he appears to the 10 with Thomas. Sometime after that, he appears to the 7 by the sea. Now, that's an interesting one because when these people are with Jesus at this encounter, they share a meal with him. At his very first encounter, they watch him enjoy a meal. In the encounter with Thomas, what does Jesus offer to Thomas for him to do to not just satisfy his eyes, but what else? Touch him. And obviously, for him to have been told that, that would involve his hearing. Then we have Jesus on the mountain with the 11. The most remarkable of all, the appearance that Paul records in 1 Corinthians 15. You know, even if you were going to concede that 12 men, 11 men, a handful of women, two men on a road, that they could experience the exact same hallucination, you really, really got a problem trying to make the argument that more than 500 brethren at one time experience a hallucination in 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 6. So, the data that we have about Jesus' appearances in the Gospels, does any of this match what we know about hallucinations and how they affect people? There's no indication that you have anything in this theory that would help explain the data. And we've got some big problems in terms of the other facts that it does not account for. Okay, comments, questions about any of these three? There's other theories that people suggest. One of the other ones that's very popular is that the disciples and the women all went to the wrong tomb. Now, the problem with that objection is it implies that somebody knew which one was the right tomb. And if people knew where the right tomb was, they could easily lead these people to where Jesus was, in fact, still buried, if that was true. Of course, the other thing about it is it flies in the face of the data we have in Luke's Gospel that shows that the women carefully observed where Jesus was buried and where he was laid. And there's a myriad other theories out there, but none of them are going to hold up or explain the facts, hold up in face of the facts or explain them. So, let's look at the bottom of page 54. Every charge of fraud does not adequately address all the facts of the case. And if you're going to suggest an alternative, you've got to do that. And indeed, it does take more faith to be an atheist than it does to accept the evidence for the resurrection. Gallier Kornfeld is a skeptic, Jewish skeptic. He tends to favor the swoon theory, but he puts his own spin on it. And he seems to include the swoon theory, as we've talked about it tonight, in his very comment that he makes here. And I go back to what I said earlier. Anytime a skeptic wants to make the case for the resurrection, I'll get out of his way and let him do it. He said, certainly, the naturalistic theories stand as tributes to human ingenuity, but they all require at least as much faith to believe in their validity as in the resurrection itself. None of these theories, then, offers any solid base for historical reconstruction of what happened, and all of them raise far more difficulties than they solve. I don't know of a single one. I don't know anybody that claimed to see Jesus return from the dead that believed before they saw him that he would do that thing. So no. So if you have hallucinations in every one of these cases, you don't have the fertile ground from which hallucinations grow. The other interesting thing about it is, if these are all hallucinations, isn't it curious that the only recorded instances in history of a mass hallucination, more than one person hallucinating the exact same thing, they all happen to involve Jesus of Nazareth? I go back to what I said previously. When an objection is made, always pay attention to what they give up when they make it. And this one at least grants that people saw something, and not just one person, but many. Okay, on Sunday, we're going to shift gears and talk about something else. We're going to talk about inspiration and how we get there from the fact of the resurrection. So we'll talk about how we can believe that the Bible is the Word of God because Jesus is God's Son. I think a lot of times we argue the reverse. We believe Jesus is God's Son because the Bible is inspired. There's a more objective way to get there. And that is to say, I believe the Bible is inspired because Jesus is God's Son. I've got all this evidence. I know who He is. Now let's see what Jesus Himself had to say about the Old Testament writings and the New Testament writings. And then after we look at that, we'll talk a little bit about how we can know that we have the right books. We have a complete catalog of all the books that God wrote by His Holy Spirit through the agency of man. So Lord willing, that'll be what we talk about on Sunday. The lessons are available for you in the back. And that's our class.